Today on Maine Calling, how older people might protect themselves from fraud. A 2023 report by AARP found that older Americans lose more than $28 billion to financial exploitation. In most cases, people are victimized by someone they know. And when that happens, people usually don't report it. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we are talking with people whose mission it is to prevent financial abuse and fraud against people 60 plus. We are coming to you live from the Gracie Theater at Husson University as part of the AARP event, Dark Secrets, the Terrible Truth About Elder Abuse in the Family. We'll find out how to protect yourself, what to do if you suspect a loved one is being taken advantage of or stolen from, and how younger people can think about and plan so they won't become victims. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are broadcasting from the Gracie Theater on the campus of Husson University in Bangor. Our topic is financial fraud. It can happen to anyone. And today we'll be discussing how criminals target older people, how family members are often the perpetrators of these crimes, and what you can do to identify and prevent this type of abuse. My guest today, Kathy Stokes, who is director of AARP Fraud Prevention Programs, Benjamin Jenkins, Litigation Director for Legal Services for Maine Elders, and Philip Marshall, an elder justice advocate. His grandmother was the wealthy New York philanthropist and socialite Brooke Astor. It was Philip who helped alert authorities to the financial abuse against her. We invite you to join the conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for being here with us at the Gracie Theater in Bangor, and thank you to our audience for joining us today for this very important topic. Kathy, I'm going to start with you. I think a lot of times when people think of elder abuse, they think of physical abuse, and that is something that happens, of course. But tell us about when we're talking about financial abuse. And I know that most of you here don't like the term scam, that someone's been scammed, because you think this is something that almost lightens it, that almost makes it too cute, when in reality, this is theft.
I'm really glad you brought that up. And yeah, elder financial abuse, also known as elder financial exploitation, depending whether it's state or federal or what state you're looking at, kind of has two components. And the first is a lot of what Philip talked about this morning, which is that known perpetrator, the family member that's abusing the older adult financially. And that can be embezzlement. It could be, you know, keeping their money away from them, all the things that Philip talked about earlier. But then there's also fraud. And a lot of people would say scams. I'm trying to move away from the use of scams because it doesn't sound like a crime. And our country has really moved away from treating all elder financial exploitation, but specifically my focus being on this, what we call stranger danger fraud, that call in the middle of the night that says it's your grandson and he's in trouble and needs to send money right away. When we call it scams, when we call them scammers or fraudsters, we're really deprioritizing this as a crime. I've been in this space since 2018, and I think it was 2019 when I stepped back and I went, wait a minute, this is a crime. And I realized most people didn't understand that. So we're talking about the stranger danger stuff as well as the known perpetrator. There was a recent study by the Department of Treasury and a year's worth of reports from banks on what they call suspicious activity reports. 80% of the reports were on theft through fraud, what they refer to as scams, versus 20% being known perpetrator. And that's not to say it's been that much of a growth, but maybe it's more identifiable, but it also aligns with what we're seeing in the fraud space. Tens of billions of dollars are being stolen from people every year.
So we're learning that tens of thousands, that billions of dollars are being stolen from people every year. We're hearing that much of it, most of it, is by people who, if not family members, are known to the person who's being stolen from. Tell us, Kathy, what this looks like. What are the banks finding? Is this someone claiming to be helping that person? Is this a person claiming to be paying their mortgage for them? What are they seeing? What does it look like on the ground?
Yeah, and it's a range of things. It can be a son or the person who shows up as the long-lost nephew saying that they're providing care and they're helping their grandmother or their aunt take care of things. And they're going into the banks with them and working to try to get them to take out assets or shift assets. And there's training to try to help people kind of keep an eye on what that kind of looks like, just try to sort of intervene. It could also be people that are professionals, the crooked attorney, the crooked financial advisor, but most of it seems to be happening from, unfortunately, from a family member.
All right, and I want to return to that and the line and trying to figure out, and I know, Ben, that's probably a lot of what you're doing is the line between when is somebody indeed trying to help their family member with the finances and take care of things, and then when is this theft and when is this exploitation. But I wanted to ask you here in Maine, Ben, what are you seeing? What is the gamut of the kinds of cases that your office is working on?
Yeah, thank you. So we recently had some results from Maine's Elder Justice Roadmap, which is a coalition of groups working to address elder abuse and exploitation. And their estimates were that there were 40,000 Mainers over the age of 60 who were suffering some form of abuse each year. So it's a really big number. And if we're going to talk about financial exploitation, the estimates, you know, most of these cases aren't reported. So it's really hard for us to nail down specific numbers. But our estimates, based on a whole bunch of inputs, is that Mainers 60 and older lose between $11 and $65 million a year to financial exploitation. It's a big range, but we know that most of these crimes are not reported, and we know that when they are committed, they have a huge impact on the ability of an older Mainer to continue to live their life safely.
Why are they not reported?
So a few different reasons. There's the usual explanation of feeling shame or feeling embarrassment, but I think the more powerful reason is that many times the people who are doing the exploitation are relatives, are trusted members of the family or the community, and they are continuing to exert control over the person who's being harmed. There's coercion, there's limitation of access to the phone, there's restrictions on transportation, there's all sorts of ways that the older person who's being exploited, their world really shrinks, and their ability to connect with someone to get help also shrinks. And so we know that happens very often whenever there's financial exploitation. Unfortunately, when there is financial exploitation, there's often another form of abuse or neglect going on as well. So for all of those reasons, this crime is extremely underreported. And I think that we estimate like 1 out of 10 cases actually becomes known publicly.
What would you say, Ben, to our audience who may be concerned about someone? Maybe it's a neighbor, maybe it's a cousin, you know, not the closest family member, but a family member. Who do they contact? Before I say who do they contact, how do you know when it might be time to take a step?
I think you have to, I mean, presumably if you have a relationship with the person you're concerned about, you know what their day-to-day lives are, and you look for, are there any drastic changes in how this person is living their life? are they, you know, it's pretty simple, but what are they saying about this? How are they feeling about this? When you ask them, do you know how your bills are being paid? Do you know how your money is being handled? Those are good indicators of some, maybe some additional questions need to be asked if someone feels like they're not in control of their day-to-day lives, or they're not able to understand how their finances are being handled.
And if they're concerned, who do they contact?
It's a couple options. You know, we could, Adult Protective Services, if someone is ever worried about someone's health or safety, is a great initial contact. And of course, you know, I would put a plug in for contacting legal services for Maine Elders Hotline, helpline, because the folks who answer the phone can assess whether or not it might be a situation that needs more investigation.
All right, and why don't you say that? What is your helpline number?
Well, we have them. It's a 1-800 number that will be linked to as well, and it will be a, it's answered 5 days a week, and if anyone ever leaves a message, they get called back the next day. And if someone can't use the phone effectively, we can always come up with ways to communicate with them.
All right. And do you not know that number off the top of your head?
I'm afraid I'm going
to
get it.
Okay, we'll get back to you with that. We'll get that. We'll get that in a few minutes. Philip, I think a lot of people have heard of your grandmother, Brooke Astor. Maybe people remember reading in the news that she was the victim of financial abuse. But probably most people don't know that you were the person who, as her grandson, that really helped figure it out and pursued this as a case. Tell us what happened. This is a case where it was a family member, correct?
It was totally a family member. And this is back in the early 2000s. And quite frankly, you know, what happens at this point is my father, to make the point, my father had over years been exploiting his mother, and he was an only child, and he had only two children, twins. And at first, I didn't really know anything about elder abuse. I couldn't imagine that somebody would abuse an older adult. And then slowly I realized something was not right. And I started seeing what escalated into egregious instances of him taking advantage of his mother as she was in the throes of Alzheimer's. And what happened is, I was a professor at the time. I'm now doing elder justice full time, but I was a professor, and it was in January of 06. And I snuck in to visit my grandmother after hours because my father had a business he was operating out of a co-op on Park Avenue in New York, which apparently you're not supposed to do. But he had a watchdog, and the staff was so concerned and got me in after hours, and I first of all visited my grandmother. And then I started talking with two nurses who were changing shifts as my grandmother was asleep, and I realized I need to act. And I contacted some other people who were some of my other grandmother's, both staff at her house, but also in the Astor office. And what was tricky at first is elder abuse is the betrayal of trust. Elder justice is the promise of trust. And we didn't know if we could trust each other. We didn't know who. And all of a sudden, through that bondage of trust, we developed a great A-team. But there was that night with two nurses who were so concerned, who were spending their money out of pocket to help my grandmother, that I, in essence, gave myself permission to act. It took months of work before I acted. And as noted, acting cannot be a knee-jerk reaction. And last, you know, I'm spending my time to empower people to act, knowing that society has their back, empowering people to be responsible, knowing that that society is response-able or has the responsibility to help them. And it took me a while, but we got together that A team and were able to start efforts to helping my grandmother.
I'm so interested in what you said about trust, because I hadn't ever thought of it that way, and I've covered elder abuse for a long time, that if someone doesn't know who they can trust, it must be difficult, even if there's not Alzheimer's or dementia involved, right. It must be difficult for that person who is being stolen from, being abused, being neglected, to even know where to turn.
Completely. And as one thing, and my colleagues are probably better positioned to say that some of fraud, fraud is in part because, not because there's cognitive decline, period, but because older adults become more trusting from a neurological point of view, and that can be good. But that's a case where trust can be hacked for the kind of fraud that's being described, or by quote unquote trusted family and friends. And just as elder abuse is the betrayal of trust, elder justice being the promise of trust, elder justice, promise, and trust are all forward-looking. And as such, they are proactive and preventive in this campaign to arrest abuse before it happens. And that's really what elder justice is working on now, because damage control after the fact is insufficient.
Right. And so what I want to talk about later in the program is, and right after our break, is how all of us can get into a position where we are protecting ourselves for the future. But before we go to a break, I want to ask you, Kathy, a couple of you have used the same word, and I just want to be very clear about this. You talk about shame and how people feel ashamed, maybe ashamed to have been victimized, ashamed to have been, and I'm using air quotes here, so stupid. And I want you to be able to address that, Kathy. If someone has been stolen from, if someone has been abused in another way and they're feeling ashamed about it, what do you want to say to them?
That it's not their fault. It is the fault of the person who perpetrated the crime against them. When specifically speaking about the stranger danger kind of fraud, these are transnational criminal organizations behind this, by and large now, and they have a playbook, and they've used it since time immemorial. And that playbook says, get that target into a heightened emotional state, because when we're there in our brains, it's hard to back out and access logical thinking. So you use fear, my grandson's in trouble. You use excitement, I just won $2 million in a Mercedes-Benz. Impersonating authority to get people into that state. And the criminals call it getting them under the ether. That's why from the outside it looks like we're like, how could you let that happen? And it's not that they let it happen. They were made to believe something that isn't true.
Yeah, and what would you add to that, Ben, in terms of the cases that you're working with here in Maine? You were the one who first used this word shame, and what would you say to someone who perhaps has been taken advantage of by their child?
Well, I think the big framework that we have to look at is this is not an isolated incident. It's an incredibly common pattern across the state and across the country. We typically don't shame other victims of crime in quite the same way. And so I think some of it is making sure that when people are responding to these types of allegations, we do so with a thoughtful vocabulary and an approach that really recognizes the fact that this has been a breach of trust. I think it's also really important. I think there's a lot of misinformation about older folks losing money to scams because of diminished mental capacity. That does sometimes happen. But most of the time, it's not a diminished mental capacity that's causing the fraud or theft to happen. It's simply very effective manipulation that can impact someone of any age. And typically, people who are 60 and older are targeted because they tend to have assets that are available for someone to steal.
They've been saving all their lives.
Right. And there are many examples of people in younger generations also being financially exploited. It just isn't quite so lucrative. And so I think changing that perception of how this happens is important. It's not based on someone having dementia or Alzheimer's or some other diagnosis. It's really about effective leveraging and manipulation that causes someone to fall to, you know, fall prey to these types of crimes?
Well, we are talking about financial exploitation of people who are older than 60. Our phone number, and we'd love you to join the conversation with a phone call or a short email. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post on Facebook or Instagram, and we invite our audience here at the Gracie Theater to ask their questions as well when we get back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are broadcasting today from Husson University's Gracie Theater, and our subject is financial abuse of older adults. My guest today, Philip Marshall, who is an elder justice advocate, Benjamin Jenkins, Ben Jenkins, who's litigation director with Legal Services for Maine Elders, and Kathy Stokes, director of AARP Fraud Prevention Programs. Please join the conversation. What are your questions? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Or if you're here in the audience, raise your hand and a mic will come to you magically. Philip, before the break, we were talking about shame and the role that shame plays in helping prevent and helping investigate elder abuse cases. And what do you want to say about that?
Well, you know, Jennifer, we're at Husson University, and I was a professor for 40 years, so I'm sort of escalating in a different way and turning attention on itself in terms of shame. You know, individuals have shame, and I think as Kathy said, people feel like, oh, it's a older adult's fault for being, quote-unquote, scammed. But a lot of times, because of ageism and other social impediments, people will say, shame on you for, you know, letting, sort of just turning shame. And what happens with shame is, shame's been considered a lot, and this guy René Girard talked about mimetic theory and shame. But what he refers to in that context is those people who are shamed are scapegoated by society for society's inability to cope with social harms. And I know that's scaling it up, but that's really what it ends up being about. And just to piggyback on our experts in terms of, well, why are elders being exploited instead of a younger generation who are also exploited? If you're a international criminal organization, enterprise, would you rather go after individuals who are paying off their student loans and maybe a mortgage, or go after the $70+ trillion that older adults have? And that was said, but there's a lot of money at risk along with older adults.
During the break, Ben passed me a note, and this is the phone number for the Legal Services for the Elderly, Legal Services for Maine Elders Hotline. It is 1-800-750-5353, 1-800-750-5353. We will also put that on our website and Facebook page so that anybody who's not listening to the radio with a pen or pencil right now will be able to find that later. So let's talk about what we all can be doing to protect ourselves, and then we'll go to some of the questions from the audience. I'll turn back to you, Ben. What do you recommend? If someone's listening to this and, boy, I just turned 60, and I never thought about this before, but yeah, I'm worth more than I used to, and my kids are grown. My kids would never do this to me, but maybe I should protect myself. What's your advice?
Yeah, so there's definitely not a one-size-fits-all answer to this, because there's a couple key factors. One is, you know, what's an individual's goals for how they handle their assets, and also what their financial situation is. But we generally talk to folks about considering a financial power of attorney. That's a document that allows a trusted person to help make financial decisions. It also means that if in the future you do lose capacity to make certain financial decisions, you know that you have someone there to step in to make those decisions for you, and it's a person that you care, that you trust. The healthcare directive is really helpful because it lays out how you want your healthcare handled over the course of your life. A will is a document that determines what will happen to your stuff after you die. Having a will laid out can take some of the confusion and stress out of those decisions within a family. And then at least some limited financial planning can be really helpful to lay out how someone's finances should be handled. There's a lot of confusion about how, for instance, MaineCare works, and a fair number of our financial exploitation cases are under the guise of MaineCare planning, where a family member will say, you have to transfer your house to me or else you'll lose it to the state if you go to an assisted living facility, let's say, which is not true and can be dealt with a little bit of planning. But all of those things in combination allow the an individual to have some autonomy and some security and some peace of mind, but also to have documents to refer to when they do get pressured. They say, actually, this is already taken care of. Well, I'm not going to make an impromptu decision about something. I've worked with some folks who gave me advice, and this is what I came up with.
And are those kind of planning services something that you offer at the Legal Services for Maine Elders?
So some of them, it depends on which, some of those are more or less complex. We do offer some help with, in certain circumstances, depending on a person's income, with powers of attorney and healthcare directives. If someone has assets that really require more complex planning, then we can help make referrals so that they can get those things done.
All right. Is there anything, Philip or Kathy, you'd like to add to what Ben has said?
Yeah, I can speak to protecting ourselves from the stranger danger kind of scams out there. I mean, you might feel like there's nothing we can do. This is a huge crisis, and throw up your hands. It's the last thing I want you to walk away from, because we do have the power to protect ourselves. And I have a mentor in this space, and he refers to it as hardening the target. And we can all do some things today if we haven't done them yet, and share with everybody you know. Do things like better, stronger passwords. If you have passwords that are the same or similar, criminals have gotten so good at breaking our passwords. And if they've broken one, they can break all of them. So you really have to go with the strong and the unique. Sometimes people are comfortable with a password manager. You can actually go old school and, you know, put them in your phone, but make sure your phone has protection, so you have to sign into the phone. And then if it's in your phone, encrypt it so it's very well protected. Multi-factor authentication, where it's available, it requires that extra code when you're signing in to help confirm that it is actually you accessing your account. One thing a lot of people don't think of, update your software when you're prompted. If you have, I have an Apple phone, and sometimes I get that notification, and I'm like, oh, I don't want to deal with this right now, but deal with it, because quite often it's to patch known vulnerabilities. Better yet, set it to automatic so it just does it automatically. Same with your antivirus software if you use that. We just can't really trust incoming communication right now. It's all about validating and verifying the phone call from someone you're not you don't know, not in your list. Let it go to voicemail and consider the message. Emails, text messages with links or an 800 number saying it's your bank or it's Amazon or it's UPS. If you have accounts with these entities, go to where you know. If you have an online account, if you can pick up the phone and call them at a number you know, we just can't trust it right now. Freeze your credit. If you're not going to be taking out a loan, buying a house, buying a car, freeze your credit with the three credit agencies, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. Not the easiest thing in the world, but very protective. And once they're in place and it's free, you can lift them as needed. But if somebody steals your identity, which is a huge problem, it's going to be a heck of a lot harder for them to open accounts in your name with your information if you have that credit freeze in place. And finally, social media. It doesn't come to us safe by design, so we have to understand that there are privacy settings, and to understand those privacy settings and shut it down as much as you can so that you're only communicating with people in the community that you've invited in. Otherwise, you know, it's anyone's game.
All right. And Philip, I know this is what you're really passionate about. What would you add to what Ben and Kathy have said about how we can all protect ourselves in the future?
Kathy, great idea. Thank you. I'm freezing my credit. Okay. I think just to touch base on the healthcare proxy or advanced directive. You know, I wrote a piece recently on the three bucket list items that you should do first. And everybody goes, oh, Machu Picchu or whatever. It's like, no, The first is a healthcare proxy. And I have a helpline. It's called my iPhone. And when people call in desperation, the first thing I say is, who has healthcare proxy for their loved ones? You know, and if you don't have a healthcare proxy, it can get complicated. One way to address this is to make sure any adult, right after their 18th birthday, has a healthcare proxy. Or if you're older and don't have one, sit down and work on one and do it with your parents and say, look, I'm developing a healthcare proxy. You should too, or think about it. On the monitoring or trying to deal with financials, there are a number of companies that come up, and I'm going to mention one with a disclosure, but one called Eversafe. And Eversafe, the co-founder of Eversafe was Liz Lowy, and she was the lead prosecutor in the Burke Astor case, in my grandmother's case. And that was a six-month criminal trial. And I thought, well, Liz has been working on the Manhattan DA for a long time as head of the Elder Justice Unit. Eventually, maybe she'll move on to corporate or something. Well, Liz was co-founder of this company because what it does is it uses technology to allow other people, trusted people, for third-party viewing of accounts. And it's not just bank accounts. It's all sorts of accounts. So you can have a check and balance system before checks are written with balances never seen. And so Eversafe is quite helpful. And, you know, really, when it comes down to it, our silence protects perpetrators, not our loved ones. We need to break the silence. Perpetrators of this crime today may be strangers. Tomorrow they may be our loved ones, and perhaps in the future ourselves. And seniors in society deserve more. And the way we do that is by having these difficult conversations now.
Let's see, I'm going to go to Maureen, who's calling from here in Bangor. Hi, Maureen, go ahead.
I've never called your show, but I find this very interesting. Can you hear me okay? Because I'm on my
yes.
Bluetooth in my car.
Yeah, go
okay.
ahead.
I hate to say it, I'm in my 70s, but I find this topic amazingly disturbing because I hear so many stories. And as I say to people, I think it's a lot of it is loneliness. I say loneliness can get you in as much trouble as drugs and alcohol. Some people get mad when I say it, some laugh. But I cannot believe how lonely many and people are in my age group. And I think that affects decision-making a lot of the time. And the other thing that really I find very disturbing, and I hear stories from many people, is how their adult children are constantly sponging over money off them when they're like in their 40s. And, you know, it's very complicated. I think baby boomers led pretty turbulent lifestyles, a lot of divorces, and people are pitted against each other. And they, I don't know, I can't believe somebody 40s bumming money off a 70-something-year-old. I was a single parent. My son's a lieutenant colonel in Poland, so he doesn't call me asking for money. But I just find it very difficult. And the other thing, I don't mean to go on and on, but how people all say they have dementia. They get to a certain age and they start putting down their cognitive abilities. Like they stigmatize themselves along with what society does. And they're constantly saying, well, you know, I'm older now. I can't do things right. I can't remember this. I can't do this. I can't do that. And I'm just looking at them saying, you sound fine to me. So that's my comment.
Maureen, thank you so much for your call. Philip, I'm guessing you're going to agree with just about everything Maureen says.
Maureen, thank you. And first of all, you are correct on the lonely front and peer-reviewed literature and sociologists will and psychologists will agree with you. And that's where really when it comes to it, really focusing on our circles of support. And one thing that the governor has received federal funds, $2.5 million of federal funds, to really work on connecting caregivers in Maine with extant resources, and actually to buttress some of these resources so that we can really fortify our circles of support, recognizing at the center of our circle support for older adults are those who are caretakers, and connecting caretakers, but also experts. And I think that what's happened elsewhere is that when you mention people, basically 40-year-olds are mooching off of their parents, is, you know, the public health triumph of the 20th century gained us 30 years added to our lives. And sadly, the public health epidemic of the 21st century is challenging that, and that's elder financial exploitation. In my family's case, my grandmother was 100, and my father, who was, not to be impolite, but perhaps correct, was tied to his mother's apron strings, and eventually to her purse strings. And so all of a sudden, there was this relationship where he, maybe like some cases now where there's the fentanyl-infused son who's robbing his mother, my father was dependent on his mother and basically stealing her money. And in some ways, this is part of the downside of adding 30 years to our lives.
We do need to take another quick break. We're talking about financial abuse of people over 60. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We're live from the Gracie Theater, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. We are broadcasting from the campus of Husson University. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and we are talking about identifying and preventing financial fraud against older people. My guest today, Kathy Stokes with AARP's Fraud Prevention Programs, Philip Marshall, who is an elder justice advocate, and Benjamin Jenkins with Legal Services for Maine Elders. Share your comments and questions if you're quick. We have about 14 minutes left in the show. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I believe we have a question here in the audience. Tell us your name and what town you're from.
I'm from Bangor. My question is for Mr. Marshall. I'm just curious to know how your grandmother's life improved after this case was resolved. Was she able to have more visitors, to be able to get out more? And also, what was your relationship with your father during and after this case was resolved?
Thank you for asking. I feel that what happened was my father had closed my grandmother's country house, basically 45 minutes New York City. And she desperately wanted to get back there. And that's enough to start compelling me. It wasn't really the bad stuff that was happening in terms of abuse. We didn't even know about that. We knew bad things were happening, but basically, what happened is I filed a petition for guardianship. It was awarded. And within a week, we got my grandmother back to her country. We opened it up. It had been shuttered. All the staff had been fired, especially her quote-unquote country butler, Chris Ely. And I always call Chris my grandmother St. Christopher. Sorry. And we got Chris hired again because my father had fired him. And Chris opened up my grandmother's house. We got her back in the country, and she spent her whole last year in her country with support, with family and friends, and free from fear. And so what happened with my father's relationship, my relationship with my father ended. And that was something I realized would happen. And so it really ended. But that was not a consideration for me, because I realized to be complacent about elder justice is to be complicit in elder abuse, and I was not going to be complicit. Thank you.
We'll go to Elizabeth, who's calling from Newburgh. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. So I just want to make it as short as I can. My mother was being abused by my brother financially in Wiscasset. Went down, got my mother, got an emergency guardianship over my mother, put our lives on hold, hired a lawyer here in Bangor. We went to probate court. We proved that my brother was fiscally stealing from my mother. The judge suspended his power of attorney. And then the lawyers in Bangor proceeded to take over my mother's financial affairs and whittle it down to nothing by charging her $250 an hour. Now, I have 2 points. Number one, if I'm a family member and I did the right thing, which I did by my mother, it cost my husband and I $20,000 to get my mother out of that situation. We were completely denied by the probate court for that money back when it was proven that we were in the right and that my brother was stealing from my mother. And then the second assault was through the Bangor probate court, and the judge and the lawyers that Roberta Winchell and that whole group up there completely fleeced my mother dry. She died with $42,000 left in her $350,000 estate. Now, we did the right thing. My husband and I did the right thing, and we were completely abused by the probate system, Roberta Winchell, everyone up here in Bangor. Everybody in the probate court knows that my brother was fleecing my mother.
Elizabeth, I appreciate your story, and I want to turn to Ben. Have you heard stories like this? And do you hear Elizabeth's frustration? And what would you say to her or others who are hearing her and thinking, why would I bother?
Yeah, I mean, I can't obviously speak to that set of facts, but I think it's very common for people to feel intense frustration, and it's a difficult process. The guardianship process is very difficult. It's one of the reasons we encourage people to run through those safeguards with the power of attorney and healthcare directive in advance, because when you can put those in advance and put them in place, it alleviates the need for a guardianship, which is really helpful and also cost effective. But I do understand that process. I don't think anyone's gone through the probate guardianship process and come out the other side feeling great about it. It's a really difficult process.
Yeah, and Elizabeth makes a point that I think some other emailers and callers want to make, and that is that power of attorney can be tricky, that today we're advising people to find someone and create a power of attorney, yet it is sometimes the people who have the power of attorney who are the very people who will be doing the financial exploitation.
Well, so and that's a really good, an important point is a person who signs a power of attorney to name an agent has the ability to revoke it at any time. And so this is not written in stone. And so that's really, you know, you retain the ability to make those decisions. But it is true. There are situations where people do misuse that authority, much like they misuse all sorts of leverage and authority that they might have.
I remember years ago watching our former Attorney General Steve Rowe talk to a group of older citizens. And he said, when you're going to choose who to have your power, you know, to sign over the power of attorney to, choose your child who's doing the best financially. Is that advice that you would agree with?
We usually make a joke that anyone who wants to be an agent under a power of attorney is not a good choice, because there's no financial compensation, and it's a lot of work. And so anyone that says, I want to be your agent under a power of attorney, that's not a good choice. Someone who is responsible and reluctantly willing to do it, I think is probably a good target to identify, because anyone that thinks being an agent under a power of attorney is something they want has some questionable motives.
And Philip, what would you like to add to that?
I just thought, first of all, Elizabeth, hoping you're still on, I am so sorry to hear about what happened with you. You are not alone. And I'm not sure if you heard my keynote just before, but just to make it short, I have identified guardianship abuse and exploitation as a state-sponsored white-collar crime. And what you are describing is exactly what happens when the state comes in and family members are, oh, they're quarreling or something's wrong, and all of a sudden a lawyer is putting the meter on at $250 or $500 an hour for picking up mail, and somehow lawyers have 100-hour weeks on their schedule. It's egregious. It's a systemic harm across the country. And what I did in my keynote is I outlined ways in which Maine is beginning to address this in very constructive ways, both with aging and disability communities, and can really advance and lead the cause in both addressing guardianship, but also eventually making it obsolete.
All right, and if Philip is referring to, we are at an event here, AARP's event, Dark Secrets, the Terrible Truth About Elder Abuse in the Family, and Philip was the keynote speaker right before Maine calling this morning. We'll go to Margaret, who's calling from Jefferson. Hi, Margaret, go ahead.
Hey there. I'm appalled by all these stories that are very similar to the story of my mother-in-law, who I loved dearly. She gave a power of attorney to her daughter and her son-in-law, and that was under duress, and they bullied her into doing it. I found this out after the fact. And then they proceeded to buy boats and give their children all the Coca-Cola shares that my mother-in-law had. They just fleeced her. And it was over $1 million. It probably closer to $2 million. And then they put her in a home. I don't think she needed to go into a home, but they did. And they never took her to the dentist. They never took her to get new clothes. I would have gone there at least once or twice a week to just clean her room.
Margaret, I'm so sorry to hear your story, and so sorry that you are adding your voice to the number of stories that we're hearing today that all have similarities. And this reminds me of what you said earlier, Ben, that it's not usually just financial abuse.
That's right. And I think I'm worried about the idea that people may be concerned about stepping forward and addressing this issue because they're concerned about paying exorbitant legal fees. As a lawyer, I'll stand up and say many lawyers are doing amazing work, but Legal Services for Maine Elders does not charge a fee to clients. So
okay,
if you call this number, there is no charge, and we can at least assess what the legal problems might be.
And we do have an email from Jennifer saying Maine Services for the Elderly is an amazing organization helping me navigate healthcare rules under Medicare and Maine Care. Can't say how grateful I am. So there we go. We have a question from the audience. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Paul from Palermo. My concern is about the lack of oversight with the probate courts and others in powers. I mean, there was a stat earlier that 6 out of the 16 counties are actually doing audits and everything on guardians. I might have it reversed. What can we do to advocate to get that stronger and have that, more powerful?
Everybody's looking at you, Philip.
I think what I was suggesting is really heading to Augusta and letting your legislators know the people of Maine have made it clear that probate court should no longer be and cannot any longer be a county system, that it has to be part of the judicial branch. This is 50 years ago this happened, and it still hasn't occurred, and it needs to happen. And there's opposition because folks are comfortable with the system, and you can hear from callers what's happened with that. That level of comfort has led to a lot of angst. And so I would say move the probate court, adhere to, quote unquote, the Uniform Model Guardianship Act that Maine was the first nation in the country to adopt. It's a national act, but it's trying to help nationwide. And eventually, simply make guardianship obsolete and in its stead use supported decision making, which is something that's being advanced internationally with incredible success, but also in this country, in many states.
Well, that's going to be the last word today. I thank you so much, all three of our guests today. The voice you just heard, Philip Marshall, an elder justice advocate. Also with us, Benjamin Jenkins, litigation director for Legal Services for Maine Elders, and Kathy Stokes, director of AARP Fraud Prevention Programs. And a thank you to our audience for coming today, and thank you to our hosts here at Husson University. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Special thanks to Jane Margeson, to our tech team hiding behind the curtain there, John and Alex, and Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn, our producers. Thank you to everybody. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.